content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 18th, 2014 edition of the Week magazine. The main stories and how they were covered. Putin's threat to fracture Ukraine. What happened? Fears that Russia was building a pretext for an invasion of eastern Ukraine grew this week as pro-Russian demonstrators occupied government buildings in defiance of Ukraine's interim government. Armed with stun grenades and weapons, the pro-Kremlin protesters seized control in the three eastern cities of Kharkiv, Donetsk, and Luhansk, declaring the formation of People's Republics and demanding a referendum on independence. Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, ordered government forces to retake Kharkiv and said similar anti-terrorist operations would occur in the other cities if demonstrators didn't negotiate. Turchynov accused Russia of launching a special operation against Ukraine, akin to the invasion of Crimea in March, and warned that the 40,000 Russian troops massed just over the border may invade the eastern territories before the May 25th presidential election. "The enemies are trying to restage the Crimean scenario," said Turchynov, "but we will prevent it." Moscow said that Kiev's use of force could plunge the country into civil war and made clear its demands. Ukraine should postpone its upcoming election and divide the country into autonomous federalized regions. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry blasted Russia's efforts to destabilize the sovereign state of Ukraine, calling them as ham-handed as they are transparent. Kerry is scheduled to meet with Russian, Ukrainian, and EU officials next week. What the editorial said: Vladimir Putin is back on the offensive against Ukraine, said the Wall Street Journal. Last month, the Russian president planted agitators in Crimea, stirring up trouble to justify Russia's eventual invasion and annexation of the peninsula. He hasn't been any more subtle in eastern Ukraine, where Russian special agents roam freely, fomenting the unrest. Now that Putin's rubber-stamp parliament has authorized the use of Russian forces anywhere in Ukraine to protect Russian speakers, the U.S. and its allies need to ratchet up the pressure. The sanctions imposed thus far clearly are no deterrent. The Russian president's objective is all too clear, said the Financial Times. He wants to block the democratic elections that would strengthen Ukraine as a westward-looking democracy and fracture the country into republics he can control or intimidate. The U.S. and Eastern Union must impose a new wave of much tougher sanctions if Putin escalates, targeting Russia's energy, banking, and mining sectors. The Russian leader should know that intervention of any sort would lead to deep economic penalties and a long-term rupture with the West. What the columnist said: Eastern Ukraine is not like Crimea, said Simon Schuster in Time.com. It's far bigger, far less ethnically Russian, and far more economically and strategically important. At this time, Ukraine is ready to defend itself, meaning that Russian intervention could lead to full-scale war. But if the risks are greater for Russia, then so are the potential gains. Conquest would bring with it eastern Ukraine's vast reserves of natural resources and cripple Kiev's new pro-Western government, whose downfall Russia sees as a valuable end in itself. Sanctions won't deter Putin, said Angus Roxburgh in NewRepublic.com. In fact, they have produced a kind of atmosphere that dictators love, a widespread belief among Russians that they are being bullied and persecuted by the West. Since Putin annexed Crimea, Russia's nationalism and his popularity is soaring. Duma member Alexei Pushkov told me his country is overcoming the inferiority complex that was forced on us for years. Clearly, the proposed carve-up of Ukraine is not motivated by a desire to protect Russian speakers there, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. Putin cares very little about the health and welfare of Russian speakers inside Russia, where the life expectancy of a 15-year-old boy is 3 years lower than that of a 15-year-old boy in Haiti. The former KGB agent is motivated by wounded pride, said Howard LaFranchi in CS Monitor.com. Seething from President Obama's description of Russia as a regional power, he wants to prove that Russia is a country to be reckoned with. With the world now focused on Moscow's every move and military deployment, Putin, to a certain degree, has already gotten what he wanted. Our controversy of the week, Brendan Eich, the shaming of an anti-gay marriage opponent. With the legalization of gay marriage sweeping the nation, said Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com, you might think that those who fought so hard for the cause would be feeling magnanimous. Instead, they're busy bludgeoning their enemies into groveling submission. The latest to feel the gay marriage lobby's wrath is tech wizard Brendan Eich, who last week resigned under duress as CEO of Mozilla, the firm behind the Firefox web browser. Eich's departure came after a campaign by progressive activist and the OkCupid dating website, which had urged its users to boycott Firefox. Eich's crime? 6 years ago, he donated $1,000 to support Proposition 8, the 2008 ballot initiative to ban gay marriage in California. Belief in traditional marriage was no extreme mindset at the time, said Katrina Trinko in USA Today. In fact, 52% of California's electorate shared Eich's opposition to gay marriage that year, as did such noted homophobes as Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, a majority of Congress, and most Americans. Many people's views have since evolved, but when did traditional beliefs become impermissible heresy? In America, we work alongside people with whom we disagree, rather than demand that they be fired and banished from polite society. Eich is hardly a victim here, said Mary Hamilton in TheGuardian.com. When he donated to the Proposition 8 campaign, he helped bring about the invalidation of hundreds of same-sex marriages, causing great pain to those couples. So who bullied who? Yes, Eich has the right to freedom of speech, but gay Californians and their supporters also exercised their freedom of speech by calling for a boycott of Mozilla, which wisely let him step down. Generally speaking, a person's political views shouldn't affect his or her employment, said Will Oramus in Slate.com. But opposing gay marriage in modern America isn't just another political view. It bespeaks a conviction that some people do not deserve the same basic rights as others, which makes Eich as much of a problem for Mozilla as if he'd taken a stand against interracial marriage. Conservatives may find this both shocking and galling, said Tim Thiemann in TheDailyBeast.com, but the shame surrounding homosexuality has positively shifted from those who are gay to those who are anti-gay. Court after court has found that traditional arguments against gay marriage are irrational and absurd, rooted in bigotry. Now that gay people see that equality is finally within reach, it's only natural that anger flares when an example like Eich and Mozilla present itself. Ike wasn't bullied out of his job. He was shamed out of it. A CEO isn't just any employee, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. He or she is the face of the company. In Silicon Valley, where progressive politics are the norm and the competition for talented employees is intense, Ike had become a liability for Mozilla, and he had to go. As a longtime advocate of gay marriage, I see the Ike episode as a defeat, not a victory for our cause, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. We've made such rapid progress because we've patiently persuaded our fellow Americans of our humanity and of our vision of a more tolerant and diverse society. Now that we're winning the debate, it's wrong to try to silence and punish those who still disagree, some of whom do so out of sincere religious conviction. If we demand the holdouts be placed in the stocks for public shaming, it will make us no better than the anti-gay bullies who came before us. And it was a good week for making amends. After an 83-year-old Salt Lake City man, said to be racked with guilt, paid off a $1 tab at a restaurant where he dined and dashed as a 10-year-old. The man waited outside while his daughter handed $5 to a waitress to cover the meal, plus 70 years of interest. It was a good week for low-speed chases. After Royal Canadian Mounted Police commandeered a snowmobile to pursue a burglary suspect making his getaway on a stolen tractor, which stalled going up a hill. The chase certainly had some unique nuances, said a Mountie. It was a good week for the University of Connecticut, which won both the men's and women's NCAA basketball championships, with the men beating Kentucky and the women topping Notre Dame. It was a bad week for the evil empire, after Ukrainian authorities banned a man who changed his name to Darth Vader from running in the country's upcoming presidential election, suspecting he was being paid by Russia to discredit the vote. It was a bad week for justice, after a New York City court stenographer allegedly went rogue and typed, "I hate my job," over and over instead of a trial dialogue in 30 different cases. The bad transcripts may imperil convictions in at least 10 cases that are on appeal. It was a bad week for saying cheese, after workers at a Russian cheese factory posed naked for a social media photo taking a joint bath in a vat of raw milk. "We support local business," said one customer, "and they insult us like this by washing their filthy bodies in the food." Oh my. Moving on to the briefing page, Venezuela in chaos. Dozens have died in protests that have shaken Venezuela's government. Why are Venezuelans angry? What are the protests about? A broken economy, crime, shortages of basic goods, and political repression. When the populist president Hugo Chavez died last year, he left Venezuela's economy and civil society in shambles. Chavez's hand-picked successor, President Nicolas Maduro, has none of Chavez's charisma, but essentially the same socialist policies and autocratic governing style. And the country has quickly deteriorated. Its murder rate of 25,000 per year is among the world's highest, with a Venezuelan killed every 20 minutes. Crime is so bad that the government stopped tracking it, claiming the data was being politicized. Kidnappings and robberies are rampant, and the police have been corrupted by criminal gangs. Venezuela exports oil and imports nearly everything else. So when global oil prices stalled this year, it triggered a runaway annual inflation rate of 57%, as the Bolivar currency lost much of its value. Families have been unable to buy toilet paper, flour, cooking oil, and other staples. We are in a critical situation, says Caracas pollster Luis Vicente León, who warns that much of the country is near open revolt. Who is leading the protests? Protests started among students but quickly morphed into a general anti-government movement. Political opponents of Maduro, including opposition leader Leopoldo López, called for major demonstrations on February 12th, the bicentennial of the Battle of La Victoria, a pivotal moment in Venezuela's War of Independence, when students and youth joined the fight. Those marches were largely peaceful except in Caracas, where three people were killed. Maduro blamed López for the violence and ordered his arrest, and that touched off a wave of further demonstrations in cities across the country. The more harshly policed crackdown on protests, the angrier people got. The Venezuelan government has openly embraced the classic tactics of an authoritarian regime, jailing its opponents, muzzling the media, and intimidating civil society, says Jose Miguel Vivanco of Human Rights Watch. How did the protests turn violent? Mostly it's the result of a crackdown by armed pro-government militants known as colectivos. These groups have long been active in community service work in poor neighborhoods, but they also act as enforcer gangs, and now they have descended on protest camps, beating demonstrators. A subgroup of these, the motorizados, have rampaged through crowds on motorcycles and are believed to have shot and killed some of the student protest leaders. The protesters, too, have responded with violence, but less lethally, throwing rocks or stringing up wire across the streets to knock riders from their motorcycles. Maduro's security forces have also beaten protesters and may have fired live ammunition. Dozens of the more than 1,500 people arrested say they were tortured in prison. What does the government say? Maduro's government contends that the protesters are the work of fascists supported by U.S. agitators. A week after the first protest, his government kicked out three U.S. diplomats, saying they had been training, financing, and creating youth organizations to promote violence in Venezuela. Just last week, Maduro wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, taking issue with the American media narrative of repressive police versus peaceful protesters. The U.S., he said, is on the side of the 1% who wish to drag our country back to when the 99% were shut out of political life and only the few, including American companies, benefited from Venezuela's oil. He claimed that the majority of Venezuelans, the poor, support his government. Do the poor support Maduro? Their support is waning. Maduro, elected last year in a disputed vote, benefits from residual loyalty to Chavez, who led the country from his election in 1999 until his death from cancer last year. Chavez was a disciple of Cuba's Fidel Castro, and he created a largely state-run socialist economy, using Venezuela's oil wealth to fund schools and health clinics for the rural poor. The policy lifted many out of desperate poverty, and the beneficiaries are grateful. But it also strangled the economy and left the urban middle class very frustrated. December's local elections split on a rural-urban divide, with the ruling United Socialist Party taking 49%, and the opposition 43%. But in a recent poll, nearly two-thirds of Venezuelans say they wanted a change of government. That's an astounding figure, considering that most rural dwellers have little access to information about the brutality of Maduro's crackdown. State television won't cover it, and international media are blocked. How will this end? Both sides have called for mediation, but have also used inflammatory language that could lead to more violence. Maduro has been snide and insulting, calling the protesters fascist, terrorists, and Chuckies, after the psycho doll from the horror movies. Protest leaders, for their part, have described the elected government as a dictatorship engaged in genocide and have demanded that Maduro resign. And the two sides cannot agree on who should mediate. For now, with protests mainly confined to the urban middle class, the government has the upper hand. But if food shortages worsen and the barrios rise up, that could change. People will take to the streets, says activist Jose Quintero, and they won't be going home. And we take a look now at our best columns from the U.S. Healthcare debate has just begun. From Ross Douthat at the New York Times. Think the debate over Obamacare is over because 7.1 million people have signed up? Asked Ross Douthat. It's never over. Despite the premature Democratic victory lap last week, the intense policy debate that has split the country since 2009 will go on for years, decades, a generation. Our society is growing older and spending an unsustainable and ever-climbing percentage of our wealth on health care. Even in best-case scenarios, Obamacare will leave 30 million uninsured, and it's unclear how the jury-rigged complex law will affect premiums, employers' health plans, or overall cost in the future years. Full repeal isn't likely, but don't be surprised to wake up in 2020 to endless arguments about a reform of the reform of the reform. At some point, liberals will admit they want to junk Obamacare for a single-payer system, while Republicans will press for reforms that keep Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare from eating the entire national budget. The debate will be bitter, ideological, and laced with demagogy. If you think it's hard to get Washington to focus on other issues now, just wait a while. It will get much worse. From Dean Obadala at thedailybeast.com, where people care about democracy. Would you risk your life to vote? Asks Dean Obadala. What if you knew that you might get blown up by a car bomb near the polling station, or be seized by terrorists and have a finger or two cut off? In the face of such threats, about 7 million courageous and determined Afghans cast ballots last weekend, proving that despite what many cynics say, there are people in the Muslim world who embrace democracy. Indeed, the Afghan turnout of 58% of eligible voters was the same as in our 2012 presidential election, and far higher than the 41% who voted in our 2010 midterm elections to elect all 435 members of the House and 37 members of the Senate. This year's midterms may produce an even more pathetic turnout among Americans who've grown deeply cynical about our dysfunctional, money-corrupted system. So while Afghans will risk Taliban death threats to demonstrate their faith in elections, Americans sit at home on election day, watching sitcoms and keeping up with the Kardashians. If U.S. voter turnout keeps falling, at what point will we no longer be able to say with a straight face that we are a democracy? And finally, from Philip Bump at thewire.com, the most backward sport of all. Golf Digest's latest cover has outraged women golfers. But in one respect, it is perfect, said Philip Bump. The monthly magazine features Paulina Gretzky, the sexy blonde girlfriend of a pro golfer, on the cover of its May issue, in a bra and tight leggings. The last time the magazine featured an actual pro woman golfer on its cover was back in 2008. So featuring a golfer's girlfriend was tacky, sexist, elitist, and backward. But then again, so is golf. In fact, the sport has a terrible track record on every single issue of social change over the past century. Country clubs have resisted racial integration every step of the way. One Texas club admitted its first black member this year. Jews have had to start their own country clubs to circumvent blatant bigotry. Meanwhile, private courses are as elitist as ever, serving primarily as social clubs for white-collar men to manage their business relationships. All of this is done at the environment's expense, on acres of heavily watered, insecticide-drenched land. The Gretzky cover should be an embarrassment, but for golf, it's par for the course. And I thought you might enjoy the obituary this week on Mickey Rooney, 1920 to 2014, the child star who never stopped acting. For almost a decade, Mickey Rooney was America's favorite teenager. The actor starred as the scampish Andy Hardy in 15 films between 1937 and 1946, all of which revolved around the youngster making harmless mischief in his wholesome middle American neighborhood. The series made more than $75 million at the box office, a huge sum at a time when theater tickets often cost 25 cents. And in 1939, the 18-year-old Rooney, who stood just 5'2", was awarded a special Oscar for his spirit and personification of youth. But off-screen, Rooney was anything but a clean-cut Hardy boy. With reckless abandon, he chased women, partied in nightclubs, and bet on horses. "Behave yourself," he was warned by MGM studio boss Louis B. Mayer. "You are Andy Hardy. You're the United States." Rooney didn't listen. By 1962, he was bankrupt, having frittered away his $12 million fortune on booze, gambling debts, and alimony payments to his four ex-wives. He'd marry four more times. "There have been crevices, fissures, and pits," he said in 1979, "and I've fallen into a lot of them." Rooney lived most of his life in the limelight. Born Joseph Yule Jr. in Brooklyn, he made his first stage appearance at 17 months as part of his comic father and dancer mother's vaudeville performance, said USA Today. His parents split when he was four, each of them taking $20 of the $40 they had saved, and mother and son headed to Hollywood. Rooney made his film debut at age five as a midget in the silent Not to be Trusted, and appeared in dozens of movie shorts based on the Mickey Maguire comic strip character. Rooney was so closely identified with the little tough guy he played in the series, said the Los Angeles Times, he began using the name Mickey Maguire. Legal issues forced him to drop the last name, and a studio publicist and his mother suggested Rooney. By age 14, said the Boston Globe, he'd signed a long-term contract with MGM Studios and blossomed into a major star. In 1935 alone, he appeared in six films, including a big-screen adaptation of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, in which his portrayal of the sprite Puck eclipsed James Cagney's role as Bottom. But it was a 1937 movie, A Family Affair, the first of the Hardy series, that turned Rooney into a household name and, From 1939 to 1941, America's number one box office star. More hits followed. Critics praised his role as the swaggering bully redeemed by Spencer Tracy's father, Flanagan, in 1938's Boys Town. And he sang and danced his way to an Oscar nomination in the 1939 musical Babes in Arms. Rooney's success seemed unstoppable. But when he returned from World War II, having spent 2 years overseas entertaining troops, his career fell apart, said the Washington Post. He no longer looked like a child star, and the recent failure of his marriage to starlet Ava Gardner wrecked his family-friendly reputation. Rooney tried reinventing himself as a character actor, but by the 1960s, he said, there was just no demand for me. Desperate for money to fuel his expensive habits, he took every job he could, appearing in low-budget junk like 1965 beach party film, How to Stuff a Wild Bikini. The perception grew that Rooney was a has-been, and stand-up comedians cracked jokes about his string of divorces. It's like my divorces were dastardly deeds, Rooney said. But even he made fun of them. My marriage license reads, To Whom It May Concern, he once joked. In 1978, he found his final and most lasting marriage with the then 39-year-old country singer Jan Chamberlain, said the Independent, and his career began to pick up. At 59, Rooney made his Broadway debut in the 1979 song and dance spectacular Sugar Babies, earning him a Tony nomination. In 1982, Rooney won an Emmy for the TV drama Bill, about a mentally challenged man living on his own for the first time. And many critics called it his best performance. He kept bouncing along, making cameos in movies, including the 2006 Ben Stiller comedy Night at the Museum and 2011's The Muppets. Rooney said he simply couldn't imagine retiring from the spotlight. When I open a refrigerator door and the light goes on, he often joked, I want to perform. A true performer indeed. Our in-depth article, the last word section this week, is titled The Ugly Economics of Chicken. Under Tyson's rules, says Christopher Leonard, farmers take the risks, while Tyson gets most of the profits. Kenita Yandell had called the Tyson plant again and again for months, begging them to come, demanding help. She and her husband, Jerry, had been raising chickens for 2 decades, and they'd never been through anything like the past 6 months. It was a strange disease, or an industrial accident, or both. It was something gone wrong on a grand scale. The birds were simply dying. It seemed like they had started rotting even while they were still alive. She and Jerry worked 10-hour days, 7 days a week. Their labor seemed to do nothing but dig them deeper and deeper into debt. But the Yandells had no choice but to continue working. Their home, their farm, and their livelihood depended on whether the birds lived or not. About every 8 weeks, a Tyson truck delivered chicks to the Yandell farm outside Waldron, Arkansas. Jerry and Kenita's job was to raise the tens of thousands of birds, fattening them up until Tyson returned 6 weeks later to collect them for slaughter. It was a routine the couple knew well, one that defined the rhythm of their 26-year marriage and the lives of their 3 boys. It was a routine that collapsed in the fall of 2003 when the birds started dying overnight in great piles. Jerry and Kenita hadn't seen anything like it. Tyson field technicians visited the farm and looked inside the plastic freezers full of limp white carcasses. They told the Yandells to turn up the heat, turn on the fans, and give the birds more water. Kenita walked through the houses and picked the rotten birds off each other. Their bodies were like soft purple balloons by the time she gathered them. They fell apart to the touch, legs sloughing off the body when she tried to pick them up. It was like they were unraveling from the inside at a heated speed. She kept calling the Tyson Field men, asking them to come and inspect the buckets full of liquefying birds. Around Christmas, Kenita and Jerry realized it didn't matter. Whatever burned through their chickens had eaten their livelihood as well. They had taken on more than $260,000 in debt to build the chicken houses. The sickness wiped out the birds, and the dead birds wiped out their paycheck. This would be the last flock and the end of their farm, the end of their home. A crew of Tyson men came to gather the last flock, wearing plastic suits as if fending off a plague. Kenita asked them why they were dressed in biohazard suits. They told her the suits were a precaution, nothing to worry about. "I'll be ruined by this," she said. "I'll lose my farm." "I'm sorry," said one of the men. "You look at my boys and you tell them how sorry you are about it," she said. The struggles on the Yandell's farm could be observed on computers inside the offices of Tyson Foods. Tyson can measure the profitability of every square foot of space under a farmer's control, gauging how much weight the birds gained given the precisely measured amount of feed, water, and medicine Tyson provided. Tyson's employees create graphs of each farm's profitability to see in real time how efficiently the farmer transforms feed into fatter chickens. The information is aggregated on computer servers at Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale, Arkansas, where engineers search through the vital statistics from farms stretching through Georgia to Delaware to Arkansas. Tyson's headquarters is the real seat of power in the new, vertically integrated meat industry. To understand how vertical integration works and how it controls the livelihoods of people like Jerry and Kenita Yandell, it is helpful to tour the wide expanse of concrete on the north side of town in Waldron. This concrete plain is the Tyson Foods plant. It is the heart of the city, its economic lifeblood, and the reason for Waldron's existence. The Tyson plant is a self-contained rural economy. Within its fenced confines are a slaughterhouse, a feed mill, a food processing factory, a trucking lot and maintenance shop, administrative offices, a railroad spur, and a sewage plant. Decades ago, a big meat-producing town like Waldron, which pumps out millions of pounds of chicken products each week, might have contained a small network of businesses that supported and thrived from the local meat industry. There might have been several hatcheries that provided baby chicks to the farmers, one or two slaughterhouses to kill the birds when they were grown. Feed mills would have mixed raw grains into chicken food to sell to local farmers, and local trucking companies would have hauled the feed and the birds between factories and the scattered farms where chickens were raised. Under Tyson, all these businesses have been drawn onto one property. The company controls every step of meat production. The company's control spans the lifetime of the animals it raises. Before there is a chicken or an egg, there is Tyson. The company's geneticists select which kinds of birds will be grown. The birds begin their brief life at the Tyson plant, within the heated hive of its industrial hatchery. The company produces more than 2 billion eggs a year, but none of them are sold to consumers. They are all hatched inside the company's buildings, and the chicks are transported to Tyson trucks to farms, to Tyson farms. The Tyson trucks retrieve the birds 6 weeks later, bringing them back to the plant, where the chickens are hung upside down on hooks and decapitated before they travel down a disassembly line, where workers cut them apart by hand. The meat is battered, cooked, and frozen, and then sealed inside airtight bags. The bags are loaded onto Tyson trucks and taken to grocery stores, cafeterias, hospitals, and restaurants around the country. From its conception until its consumption, the bird never travels outside of Tyson's ownership and control. The company collects every penny of profit to be made along the way because it owns every step in the process. The feed dealer or local trucker or slaughterhouse owner doesn't complain about the arrangement because he simply doesn't exist anymore. The money stays inside the system, with the surplus handed over to the company's shareholders. There is one link in the chain that Tyson has decided not to own, one part of the rural economy that the company has pushed far outside the limits of its property. While most businesses are drawn steadily into the integrator's body, the force of gravity has been reversed when it comes to the farms. The farms are dumped from the balance sheet. The reason for this is simple. During the 1960s, Tyson Foods realized that chicken farming was a losing game. When Tyson executives examined operations at the company, they saw that farming was the least profitable and most risky side of the business. When they looked to invest in the future, they decided not to invest in farms. One of the people privy to these discussions was Jim Blair, who for decades was one of the company's top attorneys. You need to allocate whatever capital you have where it produces the most return on your investment. Owning the land itself wasn't in that category, Blair explained. The company was more interested in the new equipment being developed for slaughterhouses. Buying just one of the big steel machines could cut out the need for hundreds of hours of labor. That isn't true, of course, in a 400 by 40 foot wide chicken house. You can't crowd the chickens in. When there's too much chickens, you create disease and you lose efficiency. You can't keep a curve on the growth of production in the chicken house, Blair recalled. The economics of chicken farming was stubborn, and the new technology wasn't changing it. So Tyson plowed its capital into the slaughterhouses, where new dollars bought new machines that cut production time and fattened profit margins. The least profitable part of the business was left to the contract chicken farmers. Modern chicken houses are the length of several football fields and as wide across as a gymnasium. They are wired with automatic feeders, ventilation systems, watering lines, and thermostats, all of them controlled from a centralized computer system. Each house costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to build, and acres of property are needed to dispose of the waste they produce each month. Between the industrial barns and the land, a single complex can cost north of $2 million to build, and hundreds of complexes must be in continual operation to support a single Tyson plant. Farmers take out bank loans to finance the operations, and rural banks have become proficient at helping farmers become indebted. The banks have learned to break down a farmer's debt payments into a schedule that perfectly coincides with the life cycle of a flock of chickens. The farmer pays the bank every 6 weeks or so, just when his paycheck arrives from Tyson. So with every flock, the farmer is racing against his debt, hoping the birds Tyson delivers will gain enough weight to earn a payment that will cover the mortgage and the bills for electricity, heating fuel, and water. Tyson has offloaded ownership to the farms, but it maintains control. The company always owns the chickens, even after it drops them off at the farm. It doesn't sell baby chicks to the farmer and buy them back when they're grown, so the farmer never owns his business's most important asset. Tyson also owns the feed the birds eat, which is mixed at the Tyson plant according to the company's recipe, and then delivered to the farm on Tyson's trucks according to a schedule that Tyson dictates. Tyson dictates which medicine the birds receive to stave off disease and gain weight. And Tyson field veterinarians travel from farm to farm to check on the birds' health. Tyson also sets the prices for its birds. When the chickens arrive at the slaughterhouse, Tyson weighs them and tallies up how much it owes the farmer on a per-pound basis. When that price is determined, Tyson subtracts the value of the feed it delivered to grow the birds. The terms and conditions of Tyson's relationship with its farmers are laid out in a contract, the single most important document for a farmer's livelihood. It ensures the steady flow of birds a farmer needs to pay off utility bills and bank debt. But for all their importance, the contracts are usually short and simple documents. While a farmer's debt is measured in decades, the contracts are often viable for a matter of weeks and signed on a flock-to-flock basis. The contracts reserve Tyson's right to cancel the arrangement at any time. Farmers like the Yandells, who are only called farmers for lack of a better word, don't usually pay attention to the fine print of their contracts. They know it doesn't matter anyway. The power arrangement is set by Tyson, and the farmer learns the rules quickly enough, whatever the documents might say. Vertical integration gives companies like Tyson the kind of power that feudal lords once held. This was taken from The Meat Racket by Christopher Leonard, copyright 2014. Reprinted by permission from Simon & Schuster. Well, if that chicken article was disturbing, maybe you'll like this one from the Health and Science page. To live long, eat lots of veggies. Mom always said that fruits and vegetables are good for your health, but a new study has quantified just how good, and the results are remarkable. Tracking the self-reported eating habits of more than 65,000 people over 12 years, researchers at University College London found that those who consumed 7 or more daily portions, each roughly half a cup, of fresh fruits or vegetables, reduced their risk of death during the study period by 42%. The Washington Post reports this. Consuming that same amount dropped the specific risk of dying from cancer by 25% and from heart disease by 31%. The size of the effect is staggering, says researcher Oyeloni Oyebode. Even minimal consumption had a measurable impact. Eating 1 to 3 daily portions cut the risk of death by 14%. Fresh vegetables provided the biggest benefit, with each portion reducing overall risk of death by 16%. Consuming canned fruits, however, actually increased the statistical risk, likely due to the added sugar used in processing. Fruit juices had no effect at all. Researchers stressed that the findings indicate a strong association, but not necessarily causal relationship, between eating fruits and vegetables and mortality rates. And also on the Health and Science page, zebras fly repellent. Biologists since Darwin have debated this riddle. Why do zebras have stripes? A new study is now pointing to one probable answer. Flies don't like stripes. Scientists examined several leading stripe theories: that the color contrast keeps zebras cool, attract mates, provide camouflage, or create a visual effect that confuses predators, to determine which was likeliest. Researchers looked at the stripe pattern variations in 3 species of zebras, noting the thickness, location, and intensity of the markings. They then compared the species' geographic ranges with those of the tsetse flies and horseflies, along with predators like lions and hyenas, while mapping the distribution of forest and other environmental factors. The findings revealed that the zebras' territories overlapped with areas where the biting flies were most active. Again and again, there was a greater striping on areas of the body in those parts of the world where there was more annoyance from biting flies, University of California, Davis, wildlife biology professor Tim Caro tells ScienceDaily.com. Researchers noted that zebras have shorter hair than other hoofed African mammals, making them more susceptible to insect annoyance. Their next riddle? Why do stripes deter flies? Turn to the Talking Points page now. Campaign finance. Freeing the wealthy to contribute more. Money talks, said Paul Campos in Salon.com. And thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court, it will speak louder than ever before. In last week's sharply split 5-4 McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission ruling, the Supreme Court took another giant step toward getting the nation's campaign finance laws, toward gutting the nation's campaign finance laws by striking down the overall limits on how much an individual can donate to political candidates and committees per election cycle, as it did in sanctioning unlimited contributions to super PACs in Citizens United and other previous rulings. The court's conservative majority equated money with free speech, thus helping the rich transform what is putatively a democratic republic into an unapologetic plutocracy. The Roberts Court has handed a real gift to the super rich, said Alec McGillis in NewRepublic.com. Before McCutcheon, fat cat contributors were limited to giving federal candidates and party committees a generous collective total of $123,200 in every federal election cycle. Without the aggregate limit, wealthy donors are now liberated to spend up to $3.6 million on their favored party's entire roster of congressional candidates and party committees. The 646 super elite donors who maxed out their campaign contributions last year and who represent just 0.0000019% of Americans will now have even more leverage over who gets elected to Congress and what policies they favor once they get there. Don't blame the Supreme Court, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. Blame that annoying First Amendment. It guarantees the right to free speech, whether it's that of the New York Times, flag burners, neo-Nazis, or successful businessmen who want to participate in democracy. The government can make no limits on how many hours you can spend volunteering for a campaign, or how many editorials the Times can write in support of Democrats. Similarly, there should be no limits on how much money an individual can spend to promote his views. Besides, the aggregate contribution limits struck down by the court made no sense, said Walter Weber in NationalReview.com. If the maximum $2,600 campaign contributions of Alabama businessman Sean McCutcheon, the plaintiff in the case, weren't corrupting for the first nine candidates who received them, then how could it suddenly become a grave problem of Democratic legitimacy if he gave the same amount to 10, 12, or 30 candidates? That all depends on how you define corruption, said Garrett Epps in TheAtlantic.com. Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion in the case, adopted the narrowest definition possible, that of quid pro quo, corruption, outright bribery along the lines of, I will give you $200,000 to vote for my subsidy. But look how several Republican presidential hopefuls, including Chris Christie and Jeb Bush, ran to Las Vegas last week to audition for the financial support of billionaire casino owner Sheldon Adelson. A politician doesn't have to be directly bribed to give a wealthy donor's views far more weight than those of other constituents. Under the court's absurd rationale, when presidential candidates echo Adelson's positions, silly rabbit, that's not corruption. It's democracy at work. But there will always be money in politics, said David Brooks in the New York Times. The aggregate limits served only to push money to the shadowy world of billionaire-funded super PACs like American Crossroads and Restore Our Future, which, along with other organizations, spent almost $830 million in the 2012 election. Now that the overall cap has been struck down, money can start moving transparently to the political parties themselves, which are more accountable to a broad array of voters and special interests, and transcend the influence of any one. On the surface, McCutcheon is good news for the GOP, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. Past contributions indicate that the kind of super-rich donors liberated by the ruling are almost twice as likely to be Republicans as they are Democrats. But as Mitt Romney learned in 2012, being identified as the party of the rich doesn't help you get elected, especially since it turns off the blue-collar voters the GOP desperately needs to win national elections. Trying to limit political spending is both futile and unconstitutional, said Michael Kinsley in the WashingtonPost.com. But the power of spending to influence elections is only as large as we allow it to be. When a candidate accepts money from rich plutocrats for America, his opponents should make a very big deal about those contributions until the money itself becomes an issue. The solution to political speech you hate isn't to silence it. It's more and louder speech of your own. And we are winding things down here. How about this as a quote from Eudora Welty, quoted in the Boston Globe? Never think you've seen the last of anything. And perhaps you haven't, but for today you've heard the last of the week. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.